Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome back to the New Books Network. I'm your host, Jacob Barrett, and today I have the pleasure to be talking with Leslie Doros Smith and Stephen Rainey about their new textbook, Religions of the World: Questions, Challenges, and New Directions, that was just published in February 2024 with Equinox Publishing. Leslie and Stephen, welcome to the podcast, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Pleasure to be here, Jacob.
So I know this textbook has been in the works for a while and has definitely been widely anticipated. I saw as it was coming out in the months leading up, there was a lot of buzz about it. I wanted to know if you could tell me a little bit about when this project came to be, how it came to be, what made you want to do this project and take on such a big and important project.
We actually have we have two competing origin stories on this. All puns intended. And Stephen, if you jump in when
you get it wrong.
Yeah, when I get it wrong, exactly. I remember Stephen coming to me at one of, you know, the AAR conferences we were at together and saying, wouldn't it be cool if we did a textbook together, a world religions textbook, and we could tackle so many of these problems that we, you know, that we face in our classes. And then I think he remembers me asking him.
But I remember it as a conversation among people involved in the Culture and the Edge Collaborative, which is where I met Leslie and got to know her and her work. And Leslie piped up and said, has anybody thought about writing a world religions textbook? And at that point, I filed it away because I'd had that thought. But then when an opportunity came up, I thought back to that and said, Leslie is the one that would help me do this.
I'll have to watch. Yeah, exactly. Watch what you say in public, right? That does make sense. You know, I know that we were at a Culture on the Edge meeting and we were, you know, that group was really about attempting to kind of press the envelope in a lot of ways about how we study religion and about how we think about religion as a category of analysis. So it does make some sense in retrospect that conversation probably did come out of some of the work that we were doing there. But I don't even remember what year that was. Was that like 2018 or 19,
I think that was 2018.
Oh, because that was the noise of exhaustion, I guess. because we were obviously working on it across the pandemic and
we started in January of 2020, really. Mm-hmm. Thinking, okay, now how would we do this differently?
Right.
What would be the way to go of organizing a world religions textbook that doesn't reinforce the general paradigm?
Yeah.
And I've been involved in some classes where there's been an attempt to do that by just not talking about the isms, Hinduism, Buddhism, but doing it more thematically. But from my perspective and in my teaching, I find that we need to start where students are and where the public discourse about religion is, because people talk about Hinduism and Buddhism and Islam in society. But we need to do it in a way that teaches students how to think critically about those discourses. Not that those discourses are just descriptions of the world, but that they're interested. And so how do we take that goal and organize it according to traditions or religions, as you normally would in a world religions traditional class, but then problematize each of them as we go, so that students leave the class knowing a bit about what people say Hinduism is or how people talk about Judaism, but they also know some of the limitations and problems and challenges that are a part of that discourse.
Yeah, completely. I mean, I think one of the challenges of writing a book like this is that you have to know who your audience is, right? And our audience is oftentimes a group of people without a lot of life experience, and particularly not a lot of experience with cultural and religious diversity. And at the same time, while attempting to use the language that they already know to talk about this social phenomenon that we call religion, we also have to question the language and the categories that undergird it. So We were never not having theoretical conversations like that, as you can imagine, as we, I feel like every week we uncovered a new theoretical issue that would have been absolutely foreign to us even, you know, months or a year before. Everything from, you know, the images in the text to how do we do the indexing to, I mean, you know, all of the little bitty things that go into making a book that, you know, with, at least with my other books, and I'm sure with Stephen too, I didn't put necessarily a lot of thought into it. All of those things felt like they were much more important and of much greater magnitude now that we were attempting to really drill down into the assumptions that have guided world religions courses for so long. And so, you know, I fully expect that there, you know, will be some folks who critique the book and say, well, you know, it claims to do this differently, but it also reinforces these other ideas over here. And that's true. And I think that's one of the challenges of knowing your audience is that you have to both speak their language and draw from examples that they associate with this thing that they think that they've come to this class to learn, world religions, at the same time that part of that process of teaching, and even to some degree persuasion, right, is to think a little bit, is to take the familiar and help them to make it a little less familiar, to invoke J.Z. Smith, right, to take this thing that we know and to push it into a new place using some concrete examples to say maybe things aren't quite what we thought they were. So those were a lot of the conversations that undergirded those early early explorations that led us, you know, to the point that we're at now.
And I think go ahead, Stephen.
Well, it often works, and this is my first time really co-writing a book. And so for both of us, I think one of us would write a section, the other would read the section, then come back with comments and questions. And that's where a lot of those theoretical, my blind spot, Leslie's blind spot, the other person would see, maybe not blind spot, but a different way or a different angle on something that really, I think, enriched the text by the back and forth between the two of us. Also meant it took 4 years to write, but lots of Zoom meetings.
But no, that's true. This was, you know, this is my first time co-writing as well. I had co-edited a book before, but that process, you know, was a lot different because much of that co-editing was, you know, was sort of summarizing and just sort of dealing with the logistics of an edited volume. But yeah, this co-writing experience was deeply, I mean, Stephen is a terrific and brilliant partner in this, but was very fulfilling, but was also very hard. Right. And I have learned not to jump to what are the lessons you've learned from this book or, you know, some other question like that. But I learned so much about myself as a writer, as a professor, as just a person who claims some expertise about religion, through this process. So, it's been really transformative, and I hope the book, you know, is transformative for the field and for students and for, you know, that it pedagogically, it really holds up for folks. But, part of one of the reasons why I have that hope, I think, is because of how, amazing it was to work through many of the issues that we did in its creation.
Well, and I think what both of you said about this kind of multiple perspectives coming into conversation with each other and addressing the blind spots and kind of this like multiplicity of ideas coming together, I think is reflected really well in the book, because I think the way that you structure it and kind of the way that this book is different than other world religions textbooks that I've seen, it kind of at its core feels like that philosophy is there, that this like multiple perspectives, let's, instead of trying to say here's what it is, here's the right thing, here's right, a total understanding of it, like what happens if we place multiple perspectives next to each other, which I think is really important. I guess that kind of leads into a question about the structure of the book. So for those who haven't been fortunate enough to get their hands on it yet, I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about how the book is structured and what makes that different than maybe a typical world religions textbook.
Well, the book has 10 main chapters. each a different religion. So African religious traditions or Buddhism, Christianity, Chinese religions, etc. And then in each of those chapters where it really, I think, diverges from the traditional narrative, which, as you said, is kind of tells you what Hinduism is, it gives you four different representations of each of those religions. And so, for example, within there's a chapter on indigenous religions of North America, which that in and of itself was a debate between Leslie and I as to how to frame that particular, how to bound it. Is it in the U.S.? Is it North America? Is it the Americas? You know, how do we make it a manageable topic? But then how do we talk about indigenous religions? Well, we start with as local traditions, and we give three examples, the Kwakiutl in the Pacific Northwest and the Mendon in the upper Midwest and the Cherokee in the Southeast, in terms of ways that their practices and ideas are very localized and associated with the environment where they were living and existing. And that's one representation of indigenous religions as local traditions. Another is as a tradition of wisdom and harmony, and kind of this idealized image of indigenous religions. And then a third that we talked about was contemporary practices that moves into things like the Native American church, so that it moves beyond what is seen as traditionally indigenous religions to some of the forms it takes today and the ways it gets negotiated there. And then the fourth section on that one is the political influence. And each of the chapters ends with a section on political influence or legal classification or cultural influence, something that moves beyond the ideas and practices that get commonly described in each. So it has those four parts, but for each of those parts, we take a section that analyzes what is going on when we talk about it as local traditions, what choices are being made, who gets emphasized and who gets marginalized here, how is there diversity within even these local traditions. Or for wisdom and harmony, the ways also Native American traditions have been used in a negative light to talk about some of the language of Native Americans as savages and things is brought up in there, that this is not the only way it's talked about. Somebody's making a choice if they say wisdom and harmony as opposed to savages. And we may very much prefer one over the other, but we need to recognize that a choice is being made, a different element is being emphasized, and some things are being pushed to the side in any of these representations, whether it's idealized or a choice of three local traditions, or which contemporary practices do we talk about? Is it only traditional Native American practices, or is it also practices associated with Christianity? Or what about Native Americans who become Buddhist? Should they be included in here? What is the boundary line? So that becomes brought out in the analysis section, some of the choices being made.
Yeah. So every chapter has those four representations, right? And that's one of the things that really sets this book apart in a big way, I think, from most other textbooks, is that most textbooks attempt to tell kind of a singular story of a religious tradition. And, you know, they definitely along the way will say, but this is not how everyone does it, or here are the different groups. And, you know, there's a recognition that real life is not as simple as perhaps a book chapter may make it. But one of the frustrations that I think we had that probably led to that discussion years ago about doing this in the first place is that our students were coming away from our classes, you know, reading these kind of traditional textbooks, and they were hearing or they were reading that, you know, well, all Muslims, you know, follow the five pillars. And they were drawing a series of really flat and oversimplified conclusions that did not match at all the reality, that did not recognize the complexity, that didn't at all see the political little p, you know, the political dynamics that were existing within these groups. So one of the reasons why we decided to break each chapter into four pieces, so to speak, is so that we could provide four dominant images that are really popular of these traditions, but we could then stop after each image and question it openly. And we could say, okay, now who likes that image? Or when did that image historically become a thing? Or what have been the social and political forces that have bolstered this image at one point in time, but perhaps not in others? So every image or representation that we offer for each chapter has that analysis section where we kind of break down our own representation of the religion. Like we kind of, put up a stop sign and say, okay, let's stop and think about where what we've just said, comes from. I think beyond that too, one of the things that is really helpful about this textbook is that instead of, that's some pretty sophisticated philosophical stuff to some degree, particularly for a student who's never heard about the world religions paradigm, which is sort of the primary philosophical focus that we're trying to move away from in this book. And we can chat about that in just a second, but we give, in order to really give some flesh to this, what we do is that we talk about a particular representation or a popular image or an idea associated with a religion. And I'm, Stephen was talking about the chapter on indigenous religion in the Americas, or in North America. And I was looking at the chapter at the same time about Christianity. There's one of our representations in Christianity is that Christianity is the Christian theological tradition. And that's a story we tell in our world religions classes all the time, that first there was Jesus, and then this church forms, and then ultimately give it some time and it breaks into these three different big groups. But that's a story that leaves out all sorts of people. It's also a story that doesn't talk about the forms of Christianity that are not institutionally sanctioned. And so after we give that more, I don't know, typical type of representation that talks about, things like, canonical meetings and the Protestant Reformation and all of that
Right.
stuff, they get those facts. But then we stop and we analyze it and we say, okay, who isn't captured by those terms? And also, did all of those decisions, was the Nicene Creed really formed because a bunch of people got together and they absolutely agreed that this certain statement must be true? No, there was actually a lot of politics behind that. And so for every analysis portion where we kind of stop and question, or we historicize, or we really try to kind of pull the cover back so students can see some of the social mechanics behind those things, we then feature a case study at the end of each of those representations so that students can see that complexity in real life. So for that particular representation that I just discussed, which is about, Christianity is the Christian theological tradition, we give an example here of firewalking and the Greek Orthodox Church. And firewalking in some communities in Greece and in other places is incredibly popular as kind of a local cultural ritual, and yet the church itself is hesitant to support it, right? And so what does it mean where we have this thing that the people have wholeheartedly embraced in some communities, but the institution itself won't recognize it? And that's the sort of tension and nuance and sort of complexity and maybe just messiness that we're trying to really show in the book, is that these traditions are not just stories and groups of people who believe in stories, right? This is an entire social system, and what people have done with it and how they riff off of it and how they interpret it is often widely divergent. And so one of the goals of that structure that we have, that we tell students about, is that, and I think we make this pretty clear in the text, that the goal is for them not to come to the end of each chapter and think that they now know the four main ways people think about this tradition. No, the goal is to say, here are four ways. Many of those ways, by the way, contradict each other. They don't fit nicely together, and that's just how it is. So these are not meant to be sewn together, like, with a tiny thread in a way that makes a lovely patchwork quilt. These are meant to be four representations that sometimes go together and sometimes don't. And to just be really honest about the political and social and historical forces that have caused each of those images of that tradition to emerge.
Yeah, and I think what the book does really nicely is that it delivers both, you know, the knowledge that students want out of a world religions class, like you said, and also those complexities. And without, it feels like without sacrificing one for the other, which I think often happens. So I think it's all of that of what you said and the goals of what it does, I think it does really successfully. One of the, both of you have used the, have invoked the term the world religions paradigm, and people in religious studies, I would hope, are familiar with the concept. But I think the presence of so many world religions textbooks that invoke the world religions paradigm or contribute to it are not, is maybe signifier of that it has not had such a lasting thumbprint on the field as I, or knowledge about it as I would have hoped. So I just want to take the moment. Would you be able to talk about what is the world religions paradigm? Why is it problematic? And why is it important to not just drop it, or not just drop a world religions course, or say, you know, the world religions paradigm is problematic, we're not going to teach it, but to really kind of take it on and subvert it in the way that you do?
Yeah, so I first, you know, I was just trying to remember when I first heard the phrase world religions paradigm. And at least for me, I think it was when I purchased Chris Cotter and David Robertson's volume, After World Religions, Reconstructing Religious Studies. And that came out in 2016. One of the reasons why I was really struck by that book is because I didn't exactly have the language at that point as a scholar to understand the frustrations that I was experiencing in the world religions classroom. And this book gave me that language to understand exactly what that is. So in brief, the world religions paradigm is an approach to the study of religion that we could say vastly oversimplifies, and in its oversimplification kind of demolishes certain elements of how people interpret and use the category of religion. It is, at least in my mind, primarily, it's both a theoretical and a methodological critique, right? It's a critique of how we have talked about religion, and also how we have attempted to study it as a result of our pre-existing theoretical concepts. So the world religions paradigm is, you know, just sort of in brief, this notion that it's characterized by a series of assumptions, let me put it that way, a series of assumptions that are so common that most of us have them up and running. Even those of us who are scholars of religion, I would say many of us have these assumptions up and running, and absolutely our students do. So we are very upfront in the introduction to the textbook in describing the world religions paradigm and trying to be very honest and upfront about what why we're trying to move away from it. But among the things that we find problematic is that it tends to portray people who identify by the same religious label as having some sort of cohesive commonality. It tends to think about things like religious belief as the most important element of religion to a group of people. It tends to think about religion as primarily good and positive, when we know that, you know, in reality, you know, religions are made of people and people are complicated, right? And it tends to be really Christocentric, meaning it tends to, the way that so many people approach religion is from a very Christian and often a more Protestant Christian lens, right? Focusing on religion as an internal state, thinking about religion as something that is mostly about beliefs or maybe texts. And in that sort of, you know, more liberal Protestant tradition, embracing religion as the key solution to the world's social problems. And so what Cotter and Robertson, as I at least see that project, were attempting to do was to really pivot away from this series of assumptions about how religion works and how it operates. And those assumptions largely were stripping away the politics and the history and the dynamics, just the normal social dynamics of what religion means to people all across the world. And I realize that my language right there sounds like I'm about to get into kind of like a quote unquote lived religion conversation. But what I'm really getting at is that the very messy social dynamics that create any sort of widespread ideology or practice are often far more complicated than the stories that we tell about them. And so the world of religions paradigm, at least to me, represents just a tremendous oversimplification and a really Christocentric bias about what religion is, including the idea that if you are religious, that you can only embrace one religion, right? That religious affiliation is exclusive. So we outline that in great detail in the book, but it's a series of ideas that most of our students bring to class with them, which was why this was daunting, right? And we did also go round and round about how to talk about this. I mean, this is something that, you know, I know Russell McCutcheon has said before that one, I think in Critics Not Caretakers, that one of the challenges of teaching about religion is that you have a group of people coming to your class who often presume their own expertise because of their emotional or social connection to religion. And so trying to figure out a strategy for how to destabilize those assumptions that are so taken for granted that they're always going to be in the room with us, right? That was definitely one of our challenges.
I also think with the world religions paradigm, in one way we challenge it is how did these categories, Hinduism, Buddhism, Christianity, Islam, come to exist as categories that not only scholars, but the public talks about these as distinct, exclusive religions. And so looking at some of that, for me, the world religions paradigm is partially about the story of colonialism and the ways European Christians, our colonizers, largely observed parts of the world and began to divide it up into different religious identities because everybody's got a religion and there's got to be only one. So we have to figure out, when is Hinduism different from Buddhism? And so the approach to the textbook, by doing the analysis of each representation, is also trying to say who constructed it and talks about it this way, because that's not just a natural description. Too often, I think our students assume that these world religions, somebody went out into the world and observed things and figured out exactly the way the world was organized, rather than people applying an organization to the world and separating people out according to that. And so some of the chapters are focused on geographic regions, African religious traditions, Chinese religious traditions, Japanese religious traditions. And in each of those chapters, I think they're useful because they begin to raise the question, kind of like I said with indigenous religions, what counts as an African religious tradition? Is it only things that are African traditional religions? But is that one thing, or is that multiple things? Because the Yoruba and the Maasai and the Zulu have very different understandings than each other, but even among themselves, they're different understandings. But then what about Christianity in Africa and Islam in Africa? And so we have one section that talks about African religions as three competing traditions, Islam, Christianity, and African traditional religions. But then we also talk about have other sections that talk about African traditional religions as what African religion is. And then we, in some of the analysis, we said, well, but what about Hindus or Buddhists in Africa? Does that make them no longer African? Mm-hmm. When does a religion become African? And why do we even use Africa as the boundary? Because Africa is so diverse in and of itself as a landmass. And so we're trying to raise these questions so students don't see that representation as a just uninterested description of what exists in the world, but as a very interested, designed way of describing the world for very particular purposes. And the world religions paradigm is part of what we're critiquing, the way the world gets divided into these different religions. Not to say we have a better way of doing it, but just say any division of the world is making choices. And there are other choices that you could make. You could say African religions are three, or one, or many, or right. However you want to, there's not a right answer. So we want students to think critically about the answers that they are finding.
Yeah, I think one of the things that I hope we do well, I know we do it a lot in the text, is to sort of break the fourth wall. We will, at a number of times in the text, you know, this is not just how it's structured, but this is also just sort of our a consistent pattern that we worked into our writing to keep us from, in some cases, falling back into that paradigm. You know, we will ask questions like, so as Stephen just said, so who decided to call this at this point in time? Or how would the conversation we've just laid out for you and the example that we've provided you, how would that have been different if, you know, we were people asking different questions? So we try to involve ourselves actually in the text a lot more than most textbook writers do. And I certainly don't think I've ever read a world religions textbook where the authors are, you know, are talking about themselves. I mean, it's not over the top or anything, but it's certainly, we are invoking our own identities as authors. And if the student is reading the text, they will understand that we are wrestling alongside them with some of these questions, and that there are just not answers to some of them. That what we can offer instead of an easy story, again, is a series of images and representations, some context to understand who likes them, who doesn't, and in what context, and then hopefully the critical thinking skills to be able to move on from there and just ask the questions of, you know, of how representations come to be in the first place.
And I think the conversation about critiquing and thinking against the world religions paradigm is really important. One of the things that I hear a lot in various teaching environments, but from various professors who would consider themselves, you know, critical scholars and want to encourage their students to be thinking critically about religion and troubling assumptions, I hear a lot of them say, well, you know, it's really hard because especially in these intro level classes, you know, you almost have to give it to them before you can take it away, or you almost have to build it for them before you can tear it down and deconstruct it and show it that it's problematic. But I think one of the things that this book does is it has critique at the forefront the whole way through. You know, it has a critique of the world religions paradigm, and you know, you explain it and you say this is what it is, but there's kind of this important criticality throughout. And while also being an intro level textbook for a world religions class that probably is, you know, first year students or students at different levels of their college career who've never taken a religious studies class before, who've never thought critically about religion before. So I guess my question that I wanted to hear from you on is, how did you navigate kind of balancing that, like knowing the audience as early in their college career, or at least early in their college career with religious studies, and forefronting kind of a critique of the world religions paradigm, holding, you know, steadfast, like a critical religious studies approach?
Well, I believe very strongly, so this gets to soapbox, so we'll stop if I go too far, but that we can't say we'll get to the complicated stuff in the upper level courses, because the way this university functions where I am, a lot of our students take some of the intro courses or take an intro course, and that's their one time taking a religious studies course. And so what do we really need them to walk away with? In an age where we have an encyclopedia in our pocket and access to the world of information in our pocket, we don't need them as much to be able to recite the Nicene Creed or to know exactly when did the 10 Sikh gurus live. We need them to be able to think critically about the information they're going to look up on their phone. And so I want them in that one shot that we sometimes have at a student to get some of the critical thinking skills in there, to recognize that any information you're getting is coming from an interested party in this. And part of your challenge is to think about what's being left out or what interest is this particular representation serving. And so I think we try to navigate that by having it organized according to religions, so it matches what they may have heard. Even if they took a world religions class in high school, it would fit with that. But then we begin to show very quickly and put an emphasis on the ways that it can be critiqued and the different things that are being left out throughout. And so it's not like there's, you know, a couple pages at the end of the chapter or the couple pages in the introduction that are doing that. It's every few pages, you're back to that analysis because you read one representation and then you have an analysis there and then another represent. Now another analysis, we keep on coming back to it so that you can't just as easily avoid it.
Yeah. Yeah. That, you know, I was just thinking back, Stephen, to some of our early conversations about how to write a book like this. We spent a lot of time trying to figure that out. And that was, you know, there's many difficult things in writing a large book. But we spent a considerable effort attempting to navigate how do we tell students things that they need to know just in terms of kind of like cultural competencies, right? At the same time that we are providing information that makes sense to professors who will adopt the book, at the same time that we're not going to leave out the messy parts, right? That like it will be hopefully nuanced the whole way through. I think that one of the decisions that we made fairly early on, which is what ultimately inspired the structure, is that we would present students with a sort of encapsulated version of what they were often getting in a typical world religions textbook. And then after we gave them the encapsulated version, we would stop and deconstruct it. And so that's what the representation analysis, that's how that representation analysis kind of pairing began. And, you know, from that, we decided that, you know, to create four of those for each chapter. And then after that, we also decided to put a little case study at the end of each of those so that students would have a real life thing that they could look at and they could say, oh, this is complicated. Or, oh, I see how maybe these categories that I have in my brain don't really line up with what people do. Or, oh, I see how the politics of this particular issue have weighed heavily on the way that the category is constructed. I think also that there are things, you know, even like, you know, it's got a lot of pictures in it. I know that sounds kind of dumb, but I know as a student, yeah, having color pictures, right, was easier on the eyes. We have lots of like text boxes and other things like that that give further examples. So one of our hopes for the use of this text, you know, we were also thinking a lot, you know, just beyond even the student and beyond our own scholarly concerns about rigor and critique, we were also thinking a lot about how professors could use this. This is one of those books where you can incorporate any sort of case study you want about a particular tradition. You can work it in, because it's very much about representations, right? About so-and-so's image of this, you know, so, you know, what does Islam mean in this country, in this time, under these circumstances, and who says so? So this is just ripe for professors to insert their own case studies. And in fact, one of the things that we often like to challenge folks to think about if they're going to adopt the book is, you know, what other representation would you add for your class, right? Like if you would add a fifth one, let's say, or, you know, a student exercise, what are other ways to represent and think about these texts that Smith and Ramey didn't get, right? So that's kind of the point, is that we have not attempted to come up with the end all be all. There are always more social stories to tell. And so we feel like this has a lot of potential just from a pedagogical perspective too, because it's got a lot of case studies, real life examples, very interesting to students in that way. But it also is just really malleable and flexible for professors who can teach whatever parts of it they need to fit the sorts of case studies and interests that they may personally have. It doesn't force you into a sort of teaching box, so to speak. I was just thinking about the fact that I think back in like 2016 or 2017, and I, you know, actually maybe Stephen, my memory might now support your memory of the origin of this book. But I'm thinking about this. I started to reorganize my world religions classes in such a way that I started to do it basically by representations. So I'm like, here's one way to tell the story of Christianity. Here's another way to tell the story. And so I would try not, I mean, I wouldn't give them any sort of official, here's the story. I would just say, here are some stories people tell. And so I didn't do it exactly like how we have done it in the textbook, but that structure of trying to really disrupt this idea of a single thread, you know, that connects these people to this these people. We were really trying to be intentional about talking about how that's not accurate. I think another thing that the traditional textbook does is that it provides you with the single thread story, and then it tries to say, but there are so many ways that this takes shape. In a very practical way for an introductory level audience, when you tell them that this is the standard and then everyone else, you know, departs from it to some degree, what they hear is, this is the standard, right? They don't hear the nuance. And so I think that's one of the reasons why we felt like we had to take kind of a go big or go home approach to the structure, is because, you know, we've all of us who teach world religions have been shocked by what students tell us that they heard whenever they respond to us in their papers and their essays. And since they do come to this class with limited knowledge, but they often, you know, feel very confident about the knowledge that they do have, this sort of structure where we introduce the complexity immediately really did feel like a necessary corrective, because I think it would take something big. It would take something very obvious to disrupt kind of those seamless narratives that we're used to hearing.
Well, and Leslie, your comments transition really well into the last question that I want to talk about. I think one of the things that was abundantly clear to me as I was working through the book was that this was designed as a teaching resource, that it was designed with professors in mind, with classrooms in mind, because I think you know, the two of you are both excellent educators and excellent teachers, and put a lot of thought into your classes. And I know that that was really clear in this book. You talked about, you know, the different, like maybe a possible activity of, it's built kind of with this multiplicity and with the complexity, like it's really rich for sliding in your own examples or building from this, incorporating other things. I was wondering if either of you, either from experiences teaching pieces of this book or how, when you were writing it, how you would imagine teaching this book, if there were assignments or activities or things that you think would, this book would lend itself to in a classroom setting as like a, as a teaching resource kind of from, I feel like I would be remiss not to ask your pedagogical brains to share some wisdom, so.
Well, I think what Leslie was talking about is something that I've done when, because I've been teaching these chapters ever since we had a somewhat usable draft of some of the chapters when I teach Religions of the World, and is to always have a fifth representation. If you do the four within a chapter, come up with a fifth, because you want to reinforce that Smith and Ramey didn't get it all in here. There are other ways of talking about it too. And I want students to come away with that critical analysis component of it, which also means that the fifth representation or any representation you give into the class needs to be given in a way that is promoting that critical analysis. And so don't give them the one that, now this is the right one. I hope that's not what people would do with that, but be, which also means you can give one that is very negative about a religion, because you're like, but look, we're going to critique this one also. We critique the idealized version, we're going to critique the negative version also. And means when a student has their own expertise about, this is what my, you know, Chinese roommate does, or what she says her family does, you know, that's now another representation that we can talk about, not as they're wrong or they're right, but as the choice is being made in constructing in that particular way. And so it takes a little bit of the, you're not requiring their assent to anything, and you're not demeaning their representations. You're critiquing it just like you critique what's in the textbook, just like you critique what the professor gives as their representation. And so it's useful in that way, I think, this approach of representations that are seen as open to critique makes it, invites everybody into that process.
Yeah, that's definitely a big thing that I discovered whenever I changed the structure of the class, is that students, And the way that I structured it, by the way, I mean, I know that we all teach, you know, in different semester lengths, and we have different, you know, forces that influence how and when and where we teach. But I tend to do a different representation a day. And that allows me to really choose the one that I think is perhaps most most resonant with the students that I'm teaching in that class. Some exercises that I've had my students do in relation to this structure include things like, well, first of all, having them find, you know, a recent news article that has to do with an example of religion and culture, and then asking them to align it or to ask them if it does fit with any of the four representations, and to ask similar sorts of questions as the analysis section. So it's kind of like what Stephen said, is that this is asking them to perhaps create a rudimentary fifth representation on their own. Obviously, a very robust one would be something that probably the professor would be producing, but even just asking if they are able to engage similar types of questions about who portrayed it that way, who has an interest in this particular issue, you know, et cetera. And like Stephen said, in the last representation of each of these chapters is dealing with a political or cultural or legal sort of very public facing representation of that religion. And there are often case studies and examples embedded in there that are very much like what the student would find online if they were researching the role of a religion in, you know, in a legal context or in a political, you know, debate, something like this. But another thing that I've done that students really like is that this is going to sound super silly, but it works. The Oprah Winfrey Network, which is, you know, as we know, a treasure trove of scholarly religious information. The Oprah Winfrey Network some years ago created these very quick little videos that they posted to YouTube. They were like 2 or 3 minutes long. And they portrayed each major religious tradition according to them. You know, they gave an overview in 2 to 3 minutes, right? And then they had a person who is a scholar or who has some sort of background in the academic study of religion speaking there as, you know, as a person to provide sort of the, you know, image of what the religion is. And so after, you know, I always began the class, or and still do actually, talking about what the world religions paradigm is, and then helping students understand how and why we're moving away from that. And by the way, that's a very overt conversation that I have. It's very blunt. You know, it's something that we're equally as blunt about in the text. You know, this is what we're used to. We're trying to move towards something else. And so once we do that and we watch the first, you know, Oprah Winfrey video, we stop and ask ourselves, like we do a little media analysis. So what, you know, in what ways were some of those world religions paradigm ideas here? And often in any of those videos that are featuring a religion that we traditionally geographically locate, you know, in the East or in Asia, there's this very kind of stereotypically Asian music going on. And I'm just thinking, like, in the Buddhism video, there are people in a parade, and then there are monks who are meditating, and the people in the parade have one of like the big dragon kind of puppets. And so it just taps into all of those stereotypes. So we begin, and that's kind of what I've done for years. And I've used other videos too. Those were just the series that popped to mind, but we begin by taking a piece of media. And again, you know, a video breaks it up a little bit, right? Which is always important in pedagogy is breaking it up, but taking a piece of media and asking students to analyze. And what I often say is just, what if you knew nothing about anyone in this tradition, what would you think? And that's usually the question that I ask. And, you know, for Hinduism, you know, I get things like, Hindus like to throw colored paint on each other. And Hindus pray in front of statues, and Hindus are all happy and peaceful, because the images of the people who are shown in this little clip, there's a bunch of close-ups of people just, you know, looking relaxed and smiling. So we talk about that. We talk about the music. We talk about the choices that were made. And then we jump into, the more in-depth conversation about where did that come from and who says and why did Oprah's people do this, right? So that's part of what I've done for years, and that's been very successful. I will say one note about the critique about the complexity of attempting to do this. I really do think that we've found a way to make this complexity accessible. But I would also say, as a person who teaches at a university that serves a lot of first-generation students and a lot of students who are not necessarily college prepared in the way that we would hope that they would be, is I have had tremendous success with this method. And I really feel like sometimes we, you know, when we know that we work with student populations that may not be as academically prepared as we would like, that our tendency is to give them less, instead of thinking about new ways to communicate them more, right? And I think that's so important, not only for the student's dignity, but also for the dignity of our scholarship and the importance of the things that we're talking about, is that we don't sell ourselves or them or our content short. And so that's one of the things that I think I know that, you know, some folks early on when we were talking to people about our project, you know, we're very fairly like, wow, how do you do that? And of course, at that point we were like, we don't know. But as we have experimented with this, and this structure and parts of this text have been taught now in at least three or four different classrooms for at least two or three semesters before the book was ever published.
Right.
As we have been working through that and seeing what worked. So this is all, I mean, this is, we've tried this out too, right? We haven't just unleashed a book on the public that we've not, you know, I act like it's a virus or something, but you know, like we haven't put it out there without trying it. And we've tweaked where we needed to, and we've received some really helpful feedback from folks who were working with early copies of this and were telling us with what worked and what didn't and what fell flat. And that's been just really invaluable in trying to walk that fine line between the complexity that is social life and at the same time remembering our population.
Yeah. And I think that comes through so clearly in the book. It was a real treat to read through it and spend time with it. You know, I was saying this before we pressed record, but world religions classes have been something that I've spent time with and thought with and had fun with for a few years. And I think one of the things that I gleaned from one of those experiences was that in order to teach the class that the professor I was working with and I wanted to teach, it required a lot of work on our end to piece together the material. You know, we had to find the right chapters of the right books to put together the right compilation of examples, and also find the right theoretical pieces to bring in and the right videos and the right pictures and the and it was a lot of work to make it done well. And I think what I was really struck by was how this textbook kind of provides a lot of that infrastructure. And you know, the two of you spent, you know, several years putting in a lot of work into that and making that easy for people who will pick it up to teach it. So
Oh, thank you. That's a lovely compliment. But yeah, you're right. I think that was one of the reasons why there was a certain degree of, I'm not sure if urgency is, I'm not sure when you take that long that urgency is the word. But yeah, like of all of the other classes that I teach, and you know, I often don't use a book like a lot of people, right? For classes, I'll just, you know, kind of compile things. But this particular class, understanding its centrality to the curriculum of so many religion and religious studies departments, and understanding the degree to which it is often taught by part-time faculty, and understanding how, you know, most of us who are professionals in the field don't specialize in something called world religions, right? And speaking of the challenges of writing this, right, Stephen and I were affronted at all times by the limitations of our own knowledge. And it just seemed like of all of the resources that we really needed to have in the field today, it was a world religions textbook that would hopefully take some of that pressure off of the instructor to say, okay, listen, this is critical, right? It's going to promote critical thinking. We've got all the questions in there. this book and us as well, like we're not arguing that there's any single way to do this or teach this, and that this is infinitely open to flexibility in its very structure. So you can use the parts you need and skip the parts that you don't. And so thank you again for that. I really hope that that this book makes people's lives easier. I mean, I'm sure students won't think that way, right? But in terms of just, you know, the faculty who need to work with a complicated topic on ever limited budgets, and with ever limited time, this felt like the right sort of project to address right now.
Yeah. Well, thank you both for our conversation today. This was wonderful, and I'm excited to see the book out, and hopefully people go get it and teach it. So thank you both for your time today.
Thank you.
Thank you, Jacob. It's been fun.